I'm going to focus on some particular cases from the Caribbean, and I should start by saying that I'm not a scholar of the Caribbean, really. The part of the world that where I've done most research and that I've always identified mostly with and where I've spent some time is the Middle East. I went to the Caribbean for the first time last summer, in fact. But I think that the Caribbean is a useful place for interrogating various narratives about the Anthropocene for two reasons. One, it loomed large in the moment when the capitalist mode of production spread from its European heartlands to the rest of the world. And two, it has proved, most recently last autumn, extremely vulnerable to the early stages of climate breakdown. So the Caribbean was present at the beginning, and it is present at the incipient end of a very long durée indeed. And one of the narratives about this geological epoch is, of course, as you know, the story that we are all the protagonists, all of us humans, have brought about the Anthropocene in general and global warming in particular. And ironically, I already heard the name Dipesh Chakrabarty mentioned here, but ironically, two scholars who have done more than most to promote this view are Indian intellectuals rooted in post-colonial theory, Chakrabarty and Amitav Ghosh, and I will only give an example from the latter, who in 2016 published The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable, one of the most acclaimed books on the topic in recent years. And he, Amitav Ghosh, in this book offers an unusually bare-faced version of the narrative. Global warming, quote, is the unintended consequence of the very existence of human beings as a species. It is the product of the totality of human actions over time. Every human being who has ever lived has played a part in making us the dominant species on this planet. And in this sense, every human being, past and present, has contributed to the present cycle of climate change. End quote. So every human being that has ever lived has contributed to climate change. He says this explicitly. Now, if we take this seriously, it means that Arawak and Kalinago populations living in the Caribbean before 1492, hunting and fishing and practicing subsistence agriculture, somehow participated in the large-scale combustion of fossil fuels. So did a 15-year-old woman raped and beaten to death on the Middle Passage and thrown overboard. So did the enslaved black people who survived for at least a few years on the plantations. They were also human beings. The foundation for this view appears to me to be some doctrine of original sin or some hyper-deterministic and teleological philosophy of history, according to which humans were always predestined to burn fossil fuels on a mass scale, regardless of their identity and the content of their actions. It would only be, I think, slightly more absurd to claim that every human being who has ever lived has played a part in making Donald Trump the American president. This simply isn't how history works. If we take colonial history seriously, which I would argue that Anthropocene thinkers such as Chakrabarty and Ghosh simply do not, we reach very different conclusions. And I propose to take the Caribbean, and more particularly the British colonial Caribbean, as a point of departure for constructing one version of the alternative narrative about this geological epoch. And what I'm going to do here is to share just a few fragments from an ongoing research project where I look at some of these issues through the prism of wilderness. A political history of wilderness can, I believe, tell us something about how the domination of nature and the domination of labor have proceeded in tandem over the past five centuries, and what resistance to them have looked like in certain critical moments. The capitalist class was brought up on hatred against the wild. That hatred was eloquently expressed by John Locke, preeminent theorist of agrarian capitalism. In his scheme of things, the original condition of the world was that of what he called a wild common of nature. And the mission of human beings, more precisely property-owning, industrious human beings, was to abolish that condition. The wild commons of nature ought to be enclosed, rendered productive, improved, transformed, that is, into a source of profit. Locke wrote, Land that is left wholly to nature, that has no improvement of pasturage, tillage, or planting, is called, as indeed it is, waste. And we shall find the benefit of it amount to little more than nothing. End quote. So wild land is worthless waste, and more, it is an abomination in the eyes of capitalists, for it is a space of resources that has not yet been subjugated to the rule of exchange value. One space where this logic played out on an epical scale was, of course, the slave plantation. And I think you said that the plantation was a laboratory. Is that the word you used? Yeah, I think that's a very useful way of seeing it. It was a laboratory for the domination of nature and labor. And the first step in establishing a plantation was invariably to order slaves to cut down the spontaneously growing vegetation, to clear the land as it was known. Marvelously complex and diverse tropical forests were torn down to make room for the privately owned plots of land, the geometric grids of fields devoted to the cultivation of sugar, rice, coffee, or cotton. First in the Caribbean and later in the American South, land with a high degree of wildness, maintained after centuries of indigenous pre-capitalist agriculture, was ripped up and turned into radically simplified, strictly controlled sites for the production of one or a couple of commodities for export. And white settlers explicitly conceived of this as a war against wilderness. In representative terms, one chronicler of the American South described the cotton boom in Mississippi, so this is not the Caribbean, but it's the same logic. He wrote, "Fortunes were made in a day without enterprise or work. And unexampled prosperity seemed to cover the land as with a golden canopy. Forests were swept away in a week. Labor came in crowds to the south to produce cotton. And where yesterday the wilderness darkened over the land with her wild forests, today the cotton plantation whitened the earth." Land and black bodies were here reduced to the single purpose of working for white profit. And this elementary fusion of the domination of nature and the domination of labor was well understood by the slaves themselves, as evident in the very first pamphlet describing slave unrest in the New World, in Barbados, in 1676. Let's see if we... Yeah. This is, we read, a subject which has occasioned the reflection of a Negro, much quoted by the inhabitants, for saying, "The devil was in the Englishman, that he makes everything work. He makes the Negro work, the horse work, the ass work, the wood work, the water work, and the wind work." I think that's a pretty stunning quotation. What do we need to add? It is the devil that took possession of first the Englishman and then his Western European brethren in the transition to capitalism. That continues to wreck the elements of nature and the bodies of propertyless people, non-white ones in particular. And that devil had a long way to go in the 17th century. Flat like the side of a coin, the island of Barbados could be shaved clean of all forest and converted into one giant plantation. But in quite a few other colonies in the region, the planters only managed to seize hold of some spaces. And there the effect was rather the appearance of a novel contrast in space. While the plantations were confines for the tyranny of the masters, beyond them now lay a relative wilderness. The masters detested that other space as not yet cleared, untamed, savage, and in exactly the same proportion, slaves cherished it as a land of freedom. This was the space of the Maroons. And the word Maroon, as you might know, comes from the Spanish cimarrón, meaning wild or feral or unruly, used originally for cattle that had escaped into the wild. And the Maroons were then slaves who escaped into the wild for short stints or permanent settlement in remote communities. And they were, as you also might know, the chronic plague of the plantation system extending from its hinterlands, from Virginia to Peru, wherever there were wild commons of nature within reach. In her Slavery's Exiles, the story of the American Maroons, the best book, I think, among many written on Maranoche in recent years, Sylviane Diouf explains how the very act of running away dealt three blows to the system. The Maroon removed the slaveholder's property, the black body, from his grasp, deprived him of the product of her labor, and denied him authority over the reproduction of what was supposed to be his workforce. And beyond this instant subversion, the Maroons also effected a more long-lasting destabilization. They operated the Euphargos as a magnet of resistance, attracting slaves still on the plantations to rebel, proving that total control was elusive, permanently manifesting the artificiality and transience of slavery. They kept alive the imagination of the slaves, an effect that is, of course, impossible to quantify and hard to prove, given the fact that the Maroons strove for maximum secrecy and never left behind written archives. But it is an effect that has been creatively reconstructed by black writers, particularly in the French Caribbean. In the 4th century, and I've only read this stuff in English, so not in the original French language. In the 4th century, his amazing novel about the Maroons in Martinique, Edouard Glisson builds the narrative of this island's history on the contrast between the subsumed plains and the wild woods. A dichotomy he gives an almost Manichaean, Fanonian sharpness. And in the beginning, 2 slaves disembark from a ship. One of them lets himself be sold to a plantation. The other makes for the hills on his very first hour on Martinican soil. So one accepts his fate and the other refuses. The Maroon then is the vanguard, as Glisson calls him, the owner of the forest, whom the slaves subsequently seek out for counsel, the shadowy presence who makes the dream possible, or in Glisson's words, the vocation of the Maroon in the mountain is to be permanently opposed to everything below and thus to find the strength to survive. And under the right circumstances, that permanent opposition might deploy its wild troops as a force for revolution. And in Texaco, Glisson's compatriot Patrick Chamoiseau spells out this vision. The task is, I quote, to take with the utmost urgency what the Beke, the planters, is that correct pronunciation? Had not yet taken, the hills, the southern drylands, the misty heights, the depths, and the ravines, and then to besiege those places that they had created, those places in which no one could foresee our ability to unravel their history into our 1,000 stories, end quote. And such is the strategic logic of Maroon ecology. This is a typical landscape on the island of Dominica, as it still looked in early August last year. The shores rising out of the sea were, as ever, covered by impossibly green woods. On the slopes of the mountains, trees and plants jostled for a space and stretched towards the sun as though they were on the verge of leaving the ground and soaring into the sky, so that the whole place seemed to be bursting with green. It was the most densely forested country in the Caribbean. No other island in the region is so consistently mountainous. And from this base sprouted a history unlike that of any other Caribbean nation. As Lennox Honeychurch, the preeminent historian and intellectual of the country, writes in his In the Forests of Freedom, The Fighting Maroons of Dominica, the island continued to stand green and defiant until the British finally took over from Frenchmen and conquered the island in 1761. Having by then exhausted much of the soil on Barbados and other old sugar islands, British planters were clamoring for fresh land and immediately set about surveying, enclosing, auctioning, and buying plots. And the new governor invited investors with a promise of a profit rate 5 times higher than in the old colonies. But for capital accumulation to get off the ground in Dominica, however, one obstacle first had to be removed: the woods. And in a tract from 1791, planter Thomas Atwood marveled at the beauty of the trees that, I quote, by far exceed in loftiness the tallest trees in England. In this island, their tops seem to touch the clouds, which appear as if skimming swiftly over their upper branches. And then he proceeded to explain why these trees must be cut down. There could be no avoiding, I quote, the necessity, in order to render Dominica a good sugar country, of clearing the extensive forests of trees in the interior parts of it. When this is done, and not until then, Will this island be distinguished for the number of its sugar plantations and for the quantity of sugar it is absolutely capable of raising? This plan for the denudation of Dominica was never implemented. For as sure as the cat-o'-nine tails and gibbets arrived with the English, so a new people settled inside the woods, the Maroons. And with comparative ease, slaves in Dominica could head up to one of the camps in the hills, where their masters were unlikely to ever track them down. And back in August of last year, I could still see the contours of one such camp, named after the Maroon leader Jacko, who ensconced his followers on a plateau high up in the rainforest above the swift flowing river Layo, which the English unsuccessfully sought to rename the Thames. And an old farmer by the name of Magnus, with a few words of English but the most intimate knowledge of the forest and a small plot of land not far from the site, guided us. It was a steamy, rainy day. The vegetation seemed to be on a fresh riot. Figs and palms, guavas and cedars, mahoganies and tree ferns and swamp apples running over each other. The yellow land crabs, endemic to the Lesser Antilles, crawled over the trail and fenced wildly with their claws against any human feet coming close before disappearing into a puddle or hiding under some roots. The jackal parrot, endemic to Dominica, squawked in high pitch in the canopy above. Magnus picked leaves of wild basil and gave to my daughter to her delight. And having waded knee-deep through the Layo, we could take only one route up to the plateau, through stairs cut deeply into the cliffs, forming coiling defiles at their narrowest less than half a meter wide. So any company coming here would have to walk in a single file, carved high above the other, the more than 100 steps made for slow and arduous climbing. In the deepest wild of Dominica, this more than two centuries old man-made construction stood intact, a mouse trap for the English soldiers, easily picked off by Jacko's Maroons. The planters could never quite tame this island. In the Forests of Freedom, details how Dominica was effectively divided into two zones, one tiny ribbon of plantations along the coastlines, and one vast interior realm of Maroon power where the whites dared not tread. An English governor referred to the latter as an imperium in imperio, a state within a state. Loosely federated villages were ruled by black chiefs who had often been born in West Africa and knew how to arrange small huts and gardens into self-sufficient communities, protected by armed fighters and actively expanded by recruiters sent down to the estates. Inevitably, the two states came to blows. After several rounds of fighting in the early 1810s, when the colony was on the verge of collapsing due to mass flights and raids against the plantations, the English finally managed to mobilize a force that could fight the Maroons with skill and motivation. Other slaves promised their freedom if they killed a Maroon chief. So desperate blacks pitted against desperate blacks, the whites won the last war in Dominica. But it was too late. The English had missed the opportunity to turn Dominica into a lucrative sugar or cotton or coffee island. It lived through the shortest and frailest plantation system anywhere in the Caribbean. After the abolition of slavery in 1834, there was not uniquely any white ruling class that could uphold power by other means. Dominica fell to the blacks. And the former slaves retreated inland to engage in subsistence farming. And when English author Anthony Trollope stopped by in 1860, he moaned, quote, "There are no shops that can properly so be called. The people wander about, idle, chattering, listless. There is no sign of money made or money making." End quote. And from his perspective, a human society could not possibly descend to a lower state. But from the opposite perspective, the Maroons founded a high culture. With Honeychurch, their legacy has inspired a respect for the forested citadel of this island, where peasants such as Magnus practiced horticulture and trade on a small scale up until August this last year. At that point, the forest cover on the island of Dominica was greater than at any time since the English conquest. This is Cockpit Country in Western Jamaica. It is a karst landscape formed through the dissolution of limestone rocks. taking the shape of many hundreds of mountain peaks that look like cones or haystacks. If you walk alongside or between their almost perpendicular sides, you can reach deep valleys or bowls, which the English called cockpits because they reminded them of pits for cockfighting. And from above, the cockpit country looks like an egg tray. From below, the peaks appear to be shooting up like towers, and vultures loop slowly between them, scanning the forest floor for dead frogs or rats. It's more like a wall of vegetation than anything a northern European would normally associate with the word forest. It takes two people with machetes to cut through the bulwark of tree ferns and grasses and lianas, and you have to be constantly on the lookout for sinkholes and loose, sharp-edged boulders. One English 18th century governor of Jamaica despaired at this landscape as the most rugged and mountainous country in the universe. A country of rocks beyond description, wild and barren, into which no white person has ever entered. It was the base for one of the two Maroon groups that made life hell for the white settlers in Jamaica in the 17th and 18th century. Their leader was Cudjo, a runaway slave who, according to English sources, had a peculiar wildness in his manners. This is Michael Grizzle, chief of the Trelawney Town Maroons, one of the five communities in Jamaica with an unbroken lineage from the original Maroons. And he is the chairman of the local forest management committee in charge of protecting this area, which the government of Jamaica has refused to designate a national park for reasons I will probably not return to here. Anyway, here he stands at the entrance to the cockpit where Cudjo's followers had their main settlement, a gorge where, again, they could easily ambush the English soldiers. On the other side of Jamaica, high up in the eastern Blue Mountains, is the site of the base of the other original Maroon group. And here the terrain might not be quite as treacherous, but the peaks are higher and richer in long precipices and waterfalls. And getting up to the base of that camp required the worst hike that I have personally ever undertaken, a painful ascent along ravines and ridges until one reaches Stony River, the most fabled river in Jamaican Maroon culture. A stone's throw from the river is Nanny Town, or what remains of it, and here ruled the band led by Nanny, Queen of the Maroons, heroine of the Jamaican wild. In the oral traditions, Nanny is the spiritual source of independence and freedom from slavery, or as one Maroon elder told an American anthropologist in the 1970s, white men say, you fair work, Grandy Nanny say, me not working, and she take the river, follow river, she follow river. And as you can see, this imperative directly negates the long logic of the English devil. And follow the river remains a Maroon saying with deep resonances, referring in the last instance to Stony River and the space of liberty carved out around it by Nanny and her followers. And she is remembered as the magician of resistance science, as it is called in Vic Reid's novel Nanny Town. And these are some of the countless renderings of her dotting the Jamaican countryside. In Reid's literary vision, the Maroons practice a kind of rudimentary communism in Nanny Town and adore their leader as the mother of all good things. She is the head of the mothers and daughters who made their homes in the wilderness, first among equals, who gathers around her Africans from all ethnic backgrounds and tells them, it does not matter where we come from, it matters that we are here. And they salute her with the motto, the mountains are ours. And when they go out to fight the English, whose puffy red faces and stinking sweat befoul the ineffably beautiful forests, they merge with the land themselves itself. We clothe ourselves in shrubs and branches. We have become the forest. We went into battle like the flow of a river, following the bend and fall of the land. We had shown them that we were one with the forests. And at least this latter part of Reid's vision is fully confirmed by written sources from the English, who tended to perceive the Maroons and the mountains as one single threat of wild counterpower, not yet tamed. And the military techniques of these fugitive slaves was indeed the perfection of guerrilla warfare, using the landscape to one's own advantage. And the ambushes in the Cockpit Country and the Blue Mountains regularly wiped out entire English expeditions without a single Maroon being killed. And from the beginning of the English occupation in 1655, the Maroons harassed the plantations with raids, prevented their expansion into the interior of the island, and forced planters to abandon dozens of properties until in the 1730s, the colony of Jamaica reached the same point of near implosion as Dominica 80 years later. Slaves deserting en masse, discipline unraveling, the Maroons laying siege to the settler towns. Until in 1734, troops called in from Gibraltar and so-called black shots finally managed to take over Nannytown. To mark their victory over what they called the wild Negroes, the English carved an inscription into a stone that can still be seen at the site. It says, "This town was took by Colonel Brooke and after kept by Captain Cook." A few words that in all their formality convey a deep sense of certified superiority and accomplished domestication. Now, those of you who know something about the Jamaican Maroons know that things become very much more complicated after this point, but I don't have the time to go into the details of that very fascinating period here. Instead, I'm going to jump straight from the 18th to the early 21st century. This is a typical landscape on the island of Dominica as it looks today. On 18th September of last year, Hurricane Maria suddenly accelerated to a Category 5 system, one of the most explosive intensifications of a hurricane on record, and slammed straight into Dominica. Over one night, the green island turned brown. The extraordinary ferocious winds simply blew away the whole forest cover. In the words of a stunned CNN reporter, one of the first to land at the scene, "There is not a leaf on this island. The rainforests, you cannot see where they are. They're just not there." The entire infrastructure, houses, roads, bridges, hospitals, schools, was pulverized. The agricultural sector obliterated. The financial cost estimated at twice the country's GDP. But as news agency IRIN reported 1 month later, the deeper sense of loss is off the spectrum. In an earlier epoch, Dominica could perhaps have been rebuilt and the vegetation regrown. But in a warming world, we know the hurricanes will return again and again, stronger and stronger, fueled and refueled by the excess energy stored in the ever-warming and rising seas. This island has been thrown towards a state of uninhabitability. I have no idea what happened to someone like Magnus. It's a very uncanny experience to have marveled at the beauty of a place and enjoyed the company of its people, and 6 weeks later, it's gone. I don't know if you have similar experiences. Perhaps you have. These experiences are certain to become more common in the decades ahead. Dominicans are finding themselves in a new war. Martial discourse appears to have swept that people since Maria. By the time of November, after about a couple of months, something like a fifth of the population had left the island and more were leaving every week. I don't know the latest figures. Those who stay behind started to speak of themselves as soldiers on a battlefield more and more. And 5 days after the hurricane, himself now homeless, Prime Minister Roosevelt Skerritt addressed the United Nations General Assembly and he said, "I come to you straight from the front line of the war. As Dominicans bear the brunt of climate change, we are shouldering the consequences of the actions of others, actions that endanger our very existence, and all for the enrichment of a few elsewhere." The descendants of the slaves and the Maroons have done nothing to heat up this planet. They haven't made the decisions about our energy infrastructure. The same goes, of course, for Jamaica, which was mercifully spared a direct hit from the last hurricane season. It's only a matter of time before that island suffers a similar onslaught. And the same goes for all the other islands from Puerto Rico to Barbuda, more or less devastated, more or less on their knees when the next hurricane strikes. And the same goes for much of the rest of the world. If you look at this geological epoch from below, from a standpoint that is not that of the victors and the rulers, you will discover this as the typical pattern, which directly contradicts the narrative of the human species as a unified monolithic agent. Instead, the domination of nature that is a hallmark of the Anthropocene was from the very beginning inextricably bound up with the domination of labor, and in particular non-white labor, always subject to the most extreme forms of control. And conversely, maroon ecology was one of many double negations of this logic of the Anthropocene. White men say youth at work, grand and nanny say me not working, and she take the river, follow river, a strategy for survival that sought to follow nature, not subject it to the maximum production of exchange value, and that sought to escape the compulsion to work for capital. There have always been people who have resisted the dual domination of nature and labor. It's just that in the long term, the enemy has never ceased to be victorious. And from this standpoint, as has been pointed out already, I think, the very term of the Anthropocene might be a misnomer. And as you know, lots of people are toying with alternatives, such as the Capitalocene and the Plantationocene. It sounds better in French, it seems to me. I personally don't think that the name of the epoch itself is the most important thing. Whatever prefix to the scene we happen to prefer. What's really crucial is that we get the record straight and see environmental destruction as tied up with intraspecies power relations from the beginning to the end. And then we can see global warming as the final victory of the capitalist class, in a sense. The moment when there is no more land that is left wholly to nature for people like Locke to detest. When capital has taken control of the air itself and subsumed under its suffocating rule even the wildest mountains. Finally, the forests in the interior parts of Dominica have been cleared more than two centuries after Planter Atwood dreamed about it. But I'm not sure that subsumption or even domination is the appropriate category here, because the land of Dominica hasn't really been subsumed under capital. It hasn't been integrated into the process of accumulation the way a plantation was. It hasn't had its resources repurposed and re-engineered for profit. It hasn't been domesticated. It has simply been destroyed. And in that sense, climate change looks more like a war of annihilation than one of domination. And I think it is time that we recognize it, just as the Dominicans do, for the war it is. As this case shows, one group of people is killing another group or otherwise laying their lives, including their culture, their history, the very lands they stand on, to waste. It is shock and awe plus scorched earth tactics. It is affluent, predominantly white people, dumping their lethal substances over the heads of poor people, predominantly of color around the world, with immeasurable beauty also, incidentally, eradicated in the process. But is anyone fighting back? Is this a war of two combatants or only one? Earlier in the unprecedentedly catastrophic hurricane season of 2017, London Review of Books sent out essays on climate change from its archives to all subscribers. And in one of them, John Lanchester observes that, quote, "It is strange and striking that climate change activists have not committed any acts of terrorism. Indeed, it is especially noticeable when you bear in mind the ease of things like blowing up petrol stations or vandalizing SUVs. Say 50 people vandalizing four cars each night for a month, 6,000 trashed SUVs in a month, and the Chelsea tractors would soon be disappearing from our streets. So why don't these things happen?" Lanchester asked. And those words were written in 2007, before the floods in Pakistan, before the heat waves in the Persian Gulf, before the wildfires in Portugal, before the meltdown of the Arctic ecosystem set in for real, before the mudslides in Sierra Leone, before the hyperactive 2017 hurricane season in the Caribbean, and so on and so forth. It is strange and striking indeed. I think Jacko and Nanny would also agree on this. Now, this was just a little glimpse into the story of Dominica, and perhaps you were already familiar with it. I don't really know the context in which I'm speaking here, and the level of general knowledge about these things. For me, it's a pretty remarkable story, and it's just one of many, of course, that highlights what I think are integral connections between the environmental destruction that we associate with the geological epoch of the Anthropocene, or whatever we want to call it, and relations of power, and in particular relations of race. And those relations and those contradictions and conflicts and fault lines are becoming more obvious by the day, because the warmer this world gets, the higher the temperatures, the more rife are the what some would call the racial tensions in advanced capitalist countries. I would perhaps call it the rise and never-ending ascent of far-right forces that attack migrants in our continent systematically. And it seems to me that if you don't try to link contradictory relations of race to the environmental crisis, but rather opt for this kind of universalist narrative that the human species is a monolithic agent, there is no way that you can approach an analysis and understanding of the present historical conjuncture when accelerating climate change and escalating racism are clearly interlinked. So to understand this present conjuncture in all its terrible political decay, to be honest, we need to take very seriously the history of the intertwinement of white supremacy and white domination of nature and labor from the very beginning. Yeah.
Thank you. So, I'm glad to meet you. My name is Malcolm Ferdinand. I just finished a dissertation on an ecological thought from the Caribbean.
Wow. Love to see. Is it in French?
It's in French. but
so, I really appreciate the effort you made in trying to conceive these issues from the perspective of Maroons. I actually have done some work on that as well.
Wow. Also in French.
Some is in English.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it. I have to learn French.
We can share some of that. We'll exchange later. And also, linking, starting from the Maroon, going all the way to climate change, I really appreciate it. Actually, I was in the Caribbean at the same time of the hurricanes.
Yeah.
I've just published an article on a subnational climate justice from the perspective of the Outre-mer. Starting from this, the Irma, Maria, and Jose summer, so we can share.
Yes, yes,
I have two comments.
Yes.
on your presentation. The first thing is you said that in the end it doesn't matter, however we name it. So I don't understand why, because I think the power of words and the epistemologies that words convey are very important. And I think it does make a difference if we use Anthropocene or if we use Plantationocene. Mm. How far does that difference go? That remains to be seen, but it does make a difference. I mean, that's just a comment. Mm. Secondly, you say that climate change is a war of annihilation, which, looking at these images, of course, we can do nothing but agree. But you must be familiar also with the scientific debate about the direct causal relations between global warming and hurricanes. So when in discourse, people say, "Well, actually, the great countries and all the white men, like the Maroon did, commanded the wind and created the storm, and the storm in the end killed us or destroyed us." I understand that this is a discourse, but in adopting this discourse, don't you go a bit too far on the other hand without leaving space for something that is not actually human-made to 100%? It might sound strange, but are we going into the extreme in trying to embed everything that is of the natural world into a domination, a subjugation relations? And because there is a space that is maybe not necessarily made, you know, then hence the scientific debate. And I think one of the challenges Pierre referred to this morning is also how can we conceive of these power relations at the same time as accepting that there are a material aspect to it, and there are also other, we call it material entities or natural entities that are part of the world that we're trying to conceive of or to build. And I think, yeah, that was just a second remark. Mm-hmm. How do you integrate these other terms and not just subsume the natural under a fight mm-hmm. against the white men, black men?
Yeah, so first on the question of the name, I mean, I basically agree with you. I think it's probably more fruitful to experiment with words like plantationocene or capitalocene or other alternatives that have come up. It's just that when I discuss this with some people, they point out that there is good work done by scholars and others who accept the notion of the Anthropocene but still insist on power relations. And I mean, I'm not going to go after them and chase them down and say you are guilty of a major right-wing deviation or analytical error because you accept the term itself. It's not that extremely important to me, but still, you have a point. On War of Annihilation, well, this is perhaps a little bit of a rhetorical extravagance, but the point I'm trying to make is that, first of all, climate change is a process of destruction of biophysical resources. So these resources aren't subsumed, they're not integrated into capital accumulation for the purpose of making profit, they're just destroyed, wiped out. That's what happened to Dominica. Had the forest been cleared to make way for plantations, that would have been a domination. But in this case, it doesn't make sense to speak of domination. It's more of an annihilation. Now, of course, you can argue that it's not a war of annihilation in the sense that there's no intention behind it. There's no intention to exterminate anyone, which is true. On the other hand, if you look at it from a philosophical perspective, It's a form of violence that nowadays is completely mapped and the object of very widespread knowledge. So what I'm trying to say is that nowadays, I mean, you could make this argument in the 1950s that people didn't know what fossil fuel combustion entailed. Nowadays, mass combustion of fossil fuels is known widely and generally to cause mass death and to do so in the future as well. So it's more approaching a kind of war where at least the perpetrators are fine with people being killed. Even to the extent of, you know, some of the leaders of this war, notably Donald Trump, calls for more of it. You know, on Twitter he says that we should have some more of that old global warming and things like that. So it's becoming more of a war in that sense, because you can't blame lack of knowledge and things like that. Of course, there is still scientific debate going on about particular events, but the science of event attribution, the science of linking specific climatic events to underlying rise in temperature is progressing, advancing very rapidly. So nowadays, I believe it's entirely possible scientifically to say that hurricanes such as the ones that struck the Caribbean last year would not have happened without global warming, because they accelerated so rapidly and so massively, and that was because of the excess of heat in the seas. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been physically possible for them to accelerate so rapidly and become so intense. That is not to say that the war here is conducted by a group of humans against another group of humans, as if the first group, you know, were beating the second group with sticks or you know, directly attacking them. It's war that is waged through the medium of ecosystems. I think one who's been thinking quite productively about this is Rob Nixon with Slow Violence. Yes, although here it's not very slow; it's quite fast violence, but it's still mediated through ecological processes. So I think you're right on emphasizing that we shouldn't take nature out of the picture, but I think it's imperative to reserve agency to humans, because only then can you see the injustice perpetrated. The agency belongs exclusively to the humans who take up fossil fuels and combust them. The effects are articulated and materialized through nature, but nature itself, the coal itself, the clouds, the ocean, the temperature, they are not the agents that bring this about. That's my view.
I think I have two questions. The first one is about the Caribbean being a laboratory. It's a laboratory of what in your story? Because I think you clearly question the idea that it's a laboratory of environmental protection and environmental thought. It was a very fashionable idea after Richard Grove's Green Imperialism and all that stuff. I think you're right and he's wrong anyway. So that's I just want you to be more accurate about a laboratory of what. Is it a laboratory of guerrilla warfare, which I think is far more convincing. And in this case, how it relates to John McNeill's argument about Mosquito's Empire, probably his best book, where he shows that the wars in the Caribbean were not determined, but strongly influenced by the presence of certain mosquitoes, and the Maroons knew about not the mosquitoes, but the fact that certain environments were, deadly for Europeans colonies. So, I'd like to know if you could link your story with this argument by McNeill, which I think is very interesting. And the second question is probably more, perhaps a critique. When you say Dominica is on the way to inhabitability, you're using a very old concept, the notion of habitability, zona torrida, in the imperialist thinking of the Spanish of the 16th century. In a way, you could also argue that you very well showed that there were losers and winners in the Anthropocene, so that's of course a very important point. But perhaps there are also winners and losers in this after this kind of catastrophes, and to which extent this kind of catastrophes cannot fuel a new growth of capital accumulation. I'm thinking also to the what happened after the tsunami in 2004 in Sri Lanka, for instance, where you had the construction of big tourist infrastructure, which replaced the small hotels and more local capitalism that was in place before. So to which extent Dominica and the Caribbeans are going to change, not towards inhabitability, which I think is perhaps, you know, too deterministic in a way. And I mean, this notion of habitability and inhabitability, it's always Northern Europeans looking at tropical zones, and it's always, I think, a very problematic concept. I'm not saying that because you're from Sweden and we're just in a slightly less habitable place than you. And the last point about terrorism, I think it's a very important question. I mean, how come that direct action, terrorism perhaps is too strong word, but direct action is not more important. It has been very important in some places, and I'm thinking about Corsica and the role of the FLNC, which is an independentist movement. The first actions of plasticage, you know, just putting some explosives in on buildings. So the first one was about, it's in 1972. It's against a boat which belonged to the Monte Edison company, an Italian company, which the French government had authorized to just dispose, refuse near Bastia, and the first time that they used explosives. And then, you know, the fact that Corsica is still quite untouched by massive mass tourism compared to Baleares in Spain is, of course, linked to direct action. So, I mean, direct action has been very important in some particular case. But I mean, it's still, I think, a very, very, very important point that you're raising here.
So first, laboratory of what? Well, it's a good question. But I guess what I'm trying to say, and I'd be curious to to hear what you, for instance, were arguing concerning the plantation as a laboratory. I mean, to me, it seems that the Caribbean plantation was a laboratory for exerting complete domination of nature in the sense that you weeded out everything from the plantation that wasn't conducive to the production of the commodities. So everything was streamlined and planned and designed for the purpose of maximizing the production of the one or two commodities that you produced for the world market. And of course, you could find similar laboratories in the English countryside on the large estates. The novel thing about the Caribbean was, of course, the mix with African labor that was imported and subjected to the same principles, and often also regarded as, you know, on the level of animals or on the level of, you know, nature, somewhere below the white human being. So, like I said, I'm in a sense I'm kind of a newcomer to the field. So I haven't read McNeil's book on mosquitoes, to be honest. My inclination here is not to make the mosquitoes the protagonists, but rather the people themselves, someone like you probably know this much better than I do because you've studied it in much greater depth. But I'm interested in what Maroons and other groups of that kind, what they have made out of the environment they found themselves in, and how they used nature as a resource, as an asset for escaping into freedom, and how they did that without, well, they related to nature in a way opposite to the way the planters did. Because when the planters, enter the interior of Dominica, their impulse was to just cut everything down and replace it with something else. The impulse of the Maroons as people fleeing oppression and exploitation was to make use of nature as it actually was, and to hide and conceal themselves and to live from everything that they could find in the rainforests rather than destroying everything and creating something else. Yeah. So I guess the Caribbean was a laboratory of guerrilla warfare, but also of a resistance conceived through a different ecological logic, which I think people like Glisson and others have tried to pinpoint. Has Dominica become uninhabitable? Well, first of all, it's not really my invention to say so as a white, ultra-white Swede. It's something that people in Dominica say themselves. The thing is that when we were there now in August 2017, the country still licked its wounds from Tropical Storm Erika that happened in 2015, which wasn't even a hurricane on the hurricane scale. It was below the category one hurricane or tropical cyclone. But that storm was so intense that it killed something like 50 people and destroyed a number of villages, and there was still reconstruction going on. And then you had this disaster in 2017, which was, you know, several orders of magnitude worse. And it's very likely that if Dominica is spared a hit during the next hurricane season in 2020 or 21, it will be hit again and become the victim of an even more powerful hurricane, because global warming is exponential. It's not like you have a tsunami in 2007 and then nothing happens for 11 years. You know, hurricanes come every year and they get stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And if you have the level of devastation here is mind-boggling. The complete destruction of the forest cover. And there was a similar event at some point in the 20th century. It took about 20 years for the forests to recover. I mean, in 20 years. If it takes 20 years for the rainforest to recover, in 20 years you would probably have had 5 hurricanes at least of the same force. And what this means is, of course, not that the island becomes uninhabitable in an absolute sense, But it becomes impossible for people to live there in the way that they have lived there up to now, that is based on subsistence agriculture. Yeah. The thing that Dominica has tried to do, as certain other Caribbean countries, to revamp their economies after the disaster of 2015, for instance, is to start selling passports. Dominica nowadays gets a lot of state revenue by selling passports to people primarily from the Middle East who can't enter certain countries, so they pay a lot to get a Dominican passport without having any connection to the country. You can't run an economy on selling passports for a very long time. So, of course, you can replace agriculture by certain kind of fictitious capitalist inventions, but not in the long run. It could be inhabitable by, I mean, Richard Branson will probably hold on to his Virgin Islands because he has got resources to make that place inhabitable for people like himself. But Dominica was a poor country even before the disasters of 2015 and 2017. And poor people with small buffers that don't have large resources to draw on can't stay on an island if it's devastated year after year after year after year. That's how people in Dominica, as I understand it, see upon this themselves. They fear that we won't be able to stay here, and that's why people are actually leaving to Guadeloupe or Martinique, and then who knows what happens to those places. So it might sound deterministic to say that the country is becoming uninhabitable, but I think we need to see what's at stake for the actual people that are living on the ground that don't have the resources required to adapt.
My question was whether inside Dominica were they not losers and winners, saying that this division between those who win from climate change and those who lose is also present among Dominicans. So certain people perhaps benefit from this. I mean, it makes a huge resource.
But I don't know who benefits from it. I mean, even the prime minister got his house tore off. Everything was destroyed.
You got, for instance, I mean, the construction companies are going to benefit from it because they have to rebuild. That they rebuild with different materials that are going to be imported, so you can take value from that. I mean, I think capitalist is very resilient, and it could be resilient to forest destruction. I mean, the capitalists don't need this forest in a way. I mean, so.
No.
Yeah.
Sure, but then it's uninhabitable for the people that used to live there, and perhaps you can have an alien army of capitalists coming in and turning it into a profitable plantation. That's possible, yeah.
I also have a comment about the kind of political object that forests are. While listening to you, I thought about the political meaning of forest in Europe or in the Western world. And you know that the very famous of example is Thoreau seeking for shelter against civilization in Concord. But you also have, before and later in history, a call for forests by very conservative people,
yeah,
or very aristocratic-minded people,
sure,
who doesn't look for a shelter against domination, shelter against the poor, social life, or even the cultural diversity,
sure,
or the Jew, of course, like Heidegger. It's a very deep movement, I believe, in Europe. It goes as far as Carlyle in England.
As far as what? As
Carlyle.
Carlyle. Oh yeah, yeah.
For their material properties, have political affordances. See what I mean?
Mm.
Because you can take shelter in forest. But those political affordances are exploited by any kind of counter movement, progressive or emancipation movements, as the case of Maroons, and also on the other side by conservative or aristocratic minded people. And I think it might be an interesting point to keep in mind. To give a broader account of this political history of forest that I think you're trying to elaborate.
What you just described about European forest, it's also the very history of the wilderness in the US. I mean, the production of wilderness is the production of sort of the white nation. I mean, so race and wilderness in the US is so intertwined, and a lot of research has been made on that. But so just maybe to add another layer of what you just said about the Caribbean as a laboratory, and I guess I talked already about this before, but yes, so this is, I mean, it's a laboratory because you have this white domination on nature for the production of commodity for the global market, but also what is interesting in the Caribbean, as I said earlier, but as the Black Atlantic, it's also a space of intense circulations of plants and animals, and if you look about like all the research currently made by Judith Carney, for instance, about the Anglophone geography of the African Agency of environmental history, it's also like as the Caribbean finally is a space also to look as forms of, I don't like this word of resistance or resilience because you can always fall in this romantic view of resistance, but like forms of resilience, resistance, or counterproductions that are not, you don't have necessarily to go through like the ontological turn, you know, like. So that's why it's also for me like very interesting to look at this. But maybe I don't know, how do you qualify like this maroon ecology? Is it like a decolonial ontological approach, or? But so I would say that you have also the circulation layer that makes it interesting, sure, to look at. I guess Christine, you have one last comment.
Yes, I think it's the same than you. Thank you very much. Yes, I would like to use the term resistance. Even in a sense, if it knows, yes, I know the risk of being romantic, as you said, but I think that I would want to thank you very much because the plantation, yes, it's a laboratory of white domination, but it's also the laboratory of a counter-hegemonic, counter-power. It's very, if you study in the Caribbean, you find all these logics, which is power, a counter-power. I don't know one author not using the terms counter for qualifying ecology, social relationship, and so on, and memory, counter-memory. It's also a term that we use for the Caribbean. I just want to add a small comment on maroon. And the author that you have used, Glissant and Chamoiseau, one Glissant, it's amazing because Glissant find in the maroons something unachieved because of the power of the colonial power, which had made treaties, as you know. Wow. And for Jamaica is very tragic, very, very sad because it's the maroons who are stopped Moran Bay Rebellion, for example, in the 19th century. And Chamoiseau is the one who has seen the massive resistance also in the peasantry, in the black peasantry, as being a failure, as being absorbed by the industrial revolution. So I find amazing that you, but what I want to insist on is the fact that it's really a laboratory for all that things, all this articulation in the way that Pierre has made, has souligné, the articulation with ontological mode and power, and we can understand. It's for what we want a world group to construct the Caribbean as a paradigm of all that things. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I could go on for quite a long time on the legacy of white racist wilderness culture, which is very prominent still. And I could give examples of contemporary advocates of wilderness who are also very reactionary and xenophobic, people like Paul Kingsnorth and Dark Mountain group that he sort of represents, or Dave Foreman in the US and those people. I just think that there is a very fascinating history that begins actually with, I would say that it begins with people like Hagar, this slave woman who's the first in the Bible to escape into the wild, to get away from exploitation. And it goes from that all the way up to, yeah. I mean, you can find uncountable instances in recent history in Palestine or in Iran that I'm more familiar with the. I know. Yeah. Although I have disagreements with his interpretation, but. So there is a kind of subaltern tradition of wilderness practices and ideas that I think needs to be excavated and systematically explored more. So you asked, what is maroon ecology? Well, maybe it's just a fancy term. I don't see it as an ontological category or anything like that. But it's to me, it's fundamentally about slaves making use of the parts of nature that were not subsumed under the plantation system, and using those spaces as basis of freedom or as refuges for themselves. And I understand if I conveyed the impression here that the Maroons were just heroes, it's massively more complicated than that. I'd love to have a long time to discuss all the intricacies of the post-treaty period in Jamaica and the ambiguities and things like that. And not the least, the role of the Maroons in the Haitian Revolution. I just want to stress that you're absolutely right. It's more complicated. And running away into the wilderness entails perhaps a kind of separation from the masses that stayed behind on the plantations. This is also something that Glisson pinpoints quite effectively in the novel, the 4th century, that if you...
And the one who stayed on the plantation has made also cultural models of agriculture,
which
are very powerful in terms of environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.